The first case for argument this morning is Doral Juvenile Group v. DeMartinez. Mr. Peters.
May it please the court, my name is Charles Peters and I'm here this morning on behalf of Doral Juvenile Group. This case involves brand positioning strategies, and it is absolutely undisputed that brand positioning is a relative process. What I mean by a relative process is that brand positioning isn't made in the abstract. Instead, companies like Doral or the defendant's new employer, Summer Infant, very consciously look at what they expect their competitors' brand positioning strategies to be. And they develop their own brand positioning strategies in order to meet their competitors' brand positioning strategies. In essence, the brand positioning strategy is relative to what their competition is doing or expected to do. It's also completely undisputed that Summer Infant has asked the defendant, Ms. DeMartinez, to develop brand positioning strategies for the very same product categories that she worked on while she was working at my client, Doral. That includes answering the very, very specific question of what to expect from Doral. So that after working on my client's brand positioning strategies, she went to work for a competitor and was asked to answer the question, what to expect from Doral. The trial court failed to even address any of those undisputed facts. Instead, when it declined to protect my client's brand positioning strategies, it made a series of legal errors, any one of which alone would require reversal.
Now, I'd like to talk to you, please, for a moment or two about mootness. Mm-hmm. Because in your argument against mootness, you seem to be asking us to assume that the information here in question is still secret, even though the record indicates that it would have become public at least a month ago. And you are also asking us to assume that you would have asked, you would have sought an extension of the injunction. And what I'm wondering is, why should we make those assumptions? Because it seems to me that on the record as it stands, this case is moot. Is it your view that we need to go back to the district court for a hearing on the current state of this information? I mean, the timing is tough.
Yeah, I understand what the court's concern is, and let me address that. I think the court's clear in terms of what its legal standard is in terms of mootness, and that is, can this court still provide meaningful relief? I don't think that there's much dispute about that. And the answer to that question is yes, and really, as I understand, Judge Rovner, what your question is, looking at the record, how do we know that's the case? And the answer to that, I think, is looking at the burden, one, looking at exactly what the record says, and also looking at who bears the burden in of proof when it comes to mootness issues.
Well, wouldn't it be your burden to demonstrate that there's a live case?
It's actually, I think the case law that we've cited, particularly in our reply brief, Judge Rovner, is very clear that the party who is asserting mootness bears the burden of demonstrating that the case is, in fact, moot.
Even if all of the information that was presented to the district court was premised on these products entering the marketplace before April of 2007?
What the record says as to that is the testimony of my client, Vincent DeLeva, who said that he expected at that time, at the time of the preliminary injunction hearing, necessarily speculating as to what would happen in the future, that he expected the products to get into the marketplace by the first quarter of 2006. Now, he also was very clear in talking to the trial judge about certain developments, and these are confidential, and I apologize, but...
I'm trying to keep my questions as broad as possible.
But he also talked about certain developments, particularly pertaining to one brand positioning strategy, the internal developments with an entity who was directly involved with that, that created a certain amount of uncertainty, that there was a certain business transactions, business issues with that client that may delay and made it a little bit uncertain as to when it is. But the bottom line is that what this court has continually recognized is, in fact, that the party asserting mootness does bear that burden. They could file, you know, when you've seen mootness rise, indeed in cases they've talked about, the case that comes to mind is a case involving a high school athlete who was trying to maintain his athletic status, if I recall correctly. While the appeal was pending, he graduated from high school. That was a fact that was not in the record. The record was apparently supplemented in order for this court to determine that it was moot. If my client's products had shipped into the marketplace, and they haven't with the exception of one product, and I hope the court got my 28J letter that I sent yesterday, but the other two products still have not shipped, and there's nothing in the record to say that they have, in fact, shipped. The other issue why it's not moot.
I did not receive a 28J. I don't know if
I delivered it to the clerk yesterday.
I don't know if the rest of the panel did.
I have an extra copy, but let me tell you what the letter says, Judge Rovner. So the letter says that in regard to one particular product, the Quinny product, that I found out literally this week as I was preparing for oral argument that product, in fact, had shipped in late April. Now, that doesn't affect either of the two brand positioning strategies at issue, but I wanted to alert the court to that in terms of that. The other reason why it's not moot, and I think this is important in terms of meaningful relief, whether the court can grant meaningful relief, is that the Indiana trade secret statute is very clear that if there is misappropriation, so that the defendant has gotten some head start, even after the trade secret becomes public, the statute says cease to exist, the court can enter an injunction, can still enter an injunction, in order to compensate for the lead, make up for the lead time that the person's had. So in other words, in this instance, because the defendant and Summer Infant have had the advantage of knowing my client's trade secret, the brand positioning strategy, for a period of months, the trial court, can still enter an injunction enjoining Summer Infant from doing certain acts in order to make up for the lead time, the advantage that they've had while they've had access to that trade secret. So there is still very, very meaningful relief that this court can give in regard to all of the product categories at issue. Even the product that's shipped, the Quinny product, is the exact same product category.
Mr. Peters, so that I understand the sweep of your argument, suppose we didn't have this product issue as far as delivery or being out there. We had everything. We didn't have the issue that you've been discussing with Judge Rovner. But we do have a discussion by Ms. DeMartinez about five-year and 10-year strategies, and a strategy in case we're purchased. A takeover, whether that would be impact. Would those kind of discussions preclude mootness, assuming all other issues were put aside?
When you say discussions, do you mean public discussions?
No.
Internal?
We can make it hypothetical. We have an employee who is similarly situated to our case, where the in the course of the discussions about product line, obviously it's seasonal, and as it is in this industry, but there's a projection on the demographics of the population served or whatever that here's our 3, 5, and 10-year strategy, and additionally there's a strategy in case there's a takeover by a larger company in the industry, or how we might position ourselves to be more attractive or whatever. Is that the kind of discussion which preclude mootness? If that person...
Because she's already used, in essence...
Well, no, that person then moves to a competitor, And is possessed of that kind of a discussion information in her first job. Would that second job, where she now possesses that strategy of out years, as opposed to the next season's product line?
Well, I think that if I understand your hypothetical correctly, and
yeah,
I'm not certain that I do, but
where you want to go on that?
Well, I'm not. It's not. That doesn't necessarily render it moot by any stretch of the imagination.
No, I'm asking.
I understand you're asking a genuine question. I don't think. Are you asking in terms of mootness or?
Yes, yeah, I'm asking. Would that kind of discussion preclude mootness? I'm trying to get the sweep of where we would go on mootness.
Well, I think that this would become moot if. It would become moot once two things happened. The trade secret ceased to exist. It was out there, genuinely out there in the public, and the lead time that the Indiana trade secret statute talks about has already expired. Now, that is ultimately a factual determination as to what is...
That lead time is what I'm speaking of. I understand the seasonal lead time. I'm talking about what would be the lead time in discussing, in any case.
Well,
let's take this case. Suppose there is a discussion about 3 and 5 year plans for product lines based on, you know, birth rate or whatever.
Well, it would
that be the kind of thing also that could preclude mootness?
Once those plans actually had come forward. In this case, I think the lead time, and we don't have to talk about it in hypotheticals, the lead time in, for example, the Quinny product, which is where we're talking about there, she has now had the advantage of knowing about the brand positioning strategy, or at least certain elements of that brand positioning strategy, for 5 months, before the product shipped. The court could, and I think that it's ultimately a factual determination, but the court could say, from the point of a future injunction, I'm going to enjoin the defendant from engaging in certain activities for 5 months because they had 5 months where they had access to the trade secrets and were using it. And what the Indiana trade secret statute says is that you've got to compensate or may compensate for that lead time.
Well, I'm not sure if my questions will feed into Judge Flom's or not, but let me give it a try. Because I was thinking about the short shelf life of this trade secret. And one of the factors that we have to consider in deciding if the information is a trade secret is whether people who learn the secret can obtain economic value from its disclosure. So shelf life, it would seem, should be a valid concern. In other words, a secret that's public in 3 to 6 months has considerably, I would think, a less economic value than, for example, the formula for Coca-Cola, you know, which is a secret that will never become public. And as we saw this past week, people go to jail for a lot of years if they even think about it.
I am not, and I have spent a fair amount of time doing not just this trade secret case, all of them. I am not aware of any decision that says a trade secret that has a short shelf life is not entitled to a trade secret. Now, Grant, I will agree with you that there could be some de minimis time period, but generally the way that the court looks at those things is you tailor the injunction to match the period in which the trade secret remains secret. The unique aspect of trade secret law is that as long as the information remains secret, it is entitled to protection. And in this case, there isn't any dispute that the brand positioning strategy, certainly in regard to two of the three strategies, and I would say certain elements of even the Quinny strategy that are not public just because it's been published, but certainly those strategies still remain secret, and that there is value in not letting your competition know where they're going, where you're going, in terms of meeting it. To use the analogy, the analogy that I think is absolutely apropos, and it comes from Summer Infant's executive vice president. He talked about hitting a curveball, And he said that if you know what the other side's brand position, if you know the other side's brand positioning strategy, it's like hitting a curveball. It's a lot easier to hit it when you know it's coming. And so why these trade secrets are valuable is because they remain secret. And if they 6 months in this industry, in terms of not knowing it, is very valuable because, indeed, because of the cyclical calendar year, knowing what my client would be doing in October of 2006 allows Summer Infant to begin working on the product line that it's going to talk to retail outlets in for 2000 in 2007 to sell in 2008. So that 6 month window has ramifications going forward for the entire sales year of 2008.
Where can Ms. DeMartinez work?
Where can she work?
If she were to work at this company where she went, what would the injunction allow her to do and not allow her to do?
The injunction would prohibit her from working in product categories that she worked on at Durrell, where she that relate to these trade secrets.
Well, there's not they had basically two types of. I don't understand the
terminology. Well, she could work in, she could do, I think that there are still remaining jobs that she could do still at Summer Infant. One, she can do any job that's unrelated to brand positioning. And more importantly, she can even do brand, I'm not seeking to enjoin her from engaging in brand positioning in product categories that she didn't work in. For example, there was a lot of evidence, or there was evidence about Summer Infant having a bedding industry. The evidence came in because there was a prior injunction entered against Summer Infant for engaging in the same type of conduct at issue here in terms of misappropriating trade secrets in the bedding industry. But she could do brand positioning work in that bedding line in those products because she didn't have access. My client doesn't do bedding, and she doesn't know my client's trade secrets or brand positioning strategy.
She wouldn't have had any experience in that, assuming. So you have to go into some kind of a new area then in order to work?
Well, she actually knows the juvenile industry. Summer Infant hadn't been in the bedding industry before that either. She knows the product. She knows the juvenile industry very well. She's worked her whole career in the juvenile industry. Whether she's dealing with strollers or potties or play yards or bedding, she knows the juvenile industry in terms of the retail outlets, the marketplace for those things, and she's absolutely free to engage in that type of work or any other job unrelated to brand positioning.
What's been going on in the meantime? Or do you know?
At Summer Infant?
Well, or what's out there? When we get to the mootness thing, this has been we're at least a month or more past when your injunction was supposed to expire, and what is going on now, and what can she do henceforth, etc. That's where I wonder where we draw the line.
Yeah, she is. The record is obviously the record doesn't deal with that, and so to answer your question, I'm going to have to go beyond the record, and I want to answer your question.
We're beyond whatever. That's the problem.
It is.
It's hard to go back to ground zero. And I guess it's a question, where are we now?
And that's why, and I will answer your question, but I do want to address the more procedural concern, why I think that the appropriate relief is, because there's error that I hope to get here, what I think that the court should do is to remand to the trial court with instructions to follow the law and to conduct further proceedings in conformity with the law in order to make those determinations. But to answer your question, the brand positioning strategies that are at issue in this case are very, very much still alive and in the process of being implemented. One of them has been delayed because of the issues that are in the confidential record, and the other one is about to ship in the near future.
Peters, what do we do with Judge Hamilton's finding that the positions are significantly different at Summer Infant and Doral? The likelihood of a problem arising is slight.
I think that with all due respect to Judge Hamilton, that's legally irrelevant in terms of the positions. Because the reason why you look at the positions, and I think, Judge Flom, you know this as well as anybody from the Redmond case, the reason why you look at the positions is to determine whether or not in that new position, is the person going to be using the trade secrets? Here, Ms. DeMartinez has admitted, everybody has admitted, that she is going to be engaging in brand positioning strategy at Summer Infant. Indeed, she has been specifically asked to answer the question, what do you expect from Durrell? Bill Redman, in the Redman case, didn't go to the same position. If I recall correctly, and you may recall better than I do, he was a general manager in California and was assuming a different position. The issue is...
We also have Redman bad faith and a finding here by the district judge of no bad faith. I mean, I appreciate the distinction you're drawing, but...
I was trying to answer the question, and I think it's important because the real issue in an inevitable disclosure case is, does the person have access to information? I see that my entire time has expired. The issue in an inevitable disclosure case is, does the person have access to a trade secret, and is it inevitable that they're going to use it? Here, there's no dispute that she had access to the trade secrets. She worked on these brand positioning strategies, and she admits that she's going to be doing brand positioning work for the competitor in the same products, including answering the very specific question, what to expect for Durrell. For those reasons, I think the court should...
We're going to give sufficient time. I'll balance this out, but the case is obviously... evoke some interest by the bench by its questions beyond normal time. Judge Hamilton said that DeMartinez didn't know any of the price points, how the products had evolved. I mean, these are facts as he finds them, or any product figures. Can we find those clearly erroneous? When we're talking about irreparable harm here.
In all due respect, again, I think he's focusing on extraneous facts. The brand positioning strategies that are the trade secrets at issue here don't deal with those specific detailed financial information. They deal with the brand positioning strategies now in terms of generally where things are going to be priced relative to where they had been priced. And I'm speaking in code to a certain extent, there's no dispute that she knew that information because she literally wrote or assisted in writing the brand positioning documents that are at issue that we've cited to in the briefing. So while there may be specific facts that Judge Hamilton is talking to, those aren't the trade secrets that are really at issue.
All right. Thank you, Ms. Peters. I know you had sought to reserve some time. We'll give some time for rebuttal.
I appreciate that. Thank you.
Mr. Finger.
May it please the Court, my name is Kevin Finger on behalf of the appellee Lois DeMartinez. Mr. Peters began his presentation by describing this case as about brand positioning, but as Judge Hamilton described it, it's general brand positioning, and that's important here in the context of his findings. What the briefing on the part of the appellant, and indeed Mr. Peters' argument, takes issue with are a number of factual findings that Judge Hamilton made in the context of denying this motion for preliminary injunction. Those findings are entitled to great deference. They are reviewed for clear error, and a decision to deny the motion for preliminary injunction can only be reversed for abuse of Judge Hamilton's discretion. But as an initial matter, there is a mootness question, and the case is moot if this court's decision will have no practical impact on the parties, and that's exactly where we are in this case.
Well, how do we know that? Why should we assume that the information is now public? I mean, do we really have enough information in the record as it stands, or do we need to remand to the district court for a brief hearing on the current status of that information?
On this record, Your Honor, the case is moot. There was a motion for preliminary injunction filed. There was a hearing conducted pursuant to that motion. And the relief that's sought in that motion is a preliminary injunction that ends April 20th, 2007. We're past that point. And just as in Stotts and in Orion and the Orion case, events, the event about which the dispute has arisen has passed. To put it in the words of Worldwide Street Preachers, the parade is over, and we can't go back and undo what would have happened over the parade. The end of the parade was April 20th, 2007, and we're, as the court has noted, 6 weeks at least past that date. That's what the relief is. In addition, there have been in the record in the trial court and then subsequently submitted by Mr. Peters some information that the information is itself public. And in addition to that, the sort of take a step back and say, if Ms. DeMartinez has not shared or used trade secrets, as Judge Hamilton had found, he found that there was no actual disclosure of trade secrets, and of course he also found that there was no inevitable disclosure of those trade secrets. If Ms. DeMartinez has not disclosed trade secrets, then there is no issue here. If the facts are otherwise, as Mr. Peters argued to Judge Hamilton, the bell can't be unrun. Whatever the situation is, there's a live controversy pending before Judge Hamilton, and that's proceeding as best we can tell. But on this record, the request for the injunction terminated April 20th, 2007, and that's all that this court can consider at this time.
What has Ms. Martinez been doing in the meantime?
I assume she's been discharging her duties at Summer Infant, Your Honor. I don't know precisely what she's been doing.
You said the case proceeds before Judge Hamilton. That's just in what stage? I mean, you said the action continues?
It is live action, Your Honor. I don't know, as I stand here today, what the state of play is on that. There had been substantial discovery taken in advance of the hearing. I don't know subsequently what's happened.
Well, my understanding was that Ms. DeMartinez was not working, and then after the injunction was denied, began to work. Is that correct?
I believe that's correct, Your Honor. I believe that's what the record reflects. She was due to start September 5th of 2006.
Right.
This case was filed in August of 2006. She did not, after the case was filed, did not go to work and assume her duties at Summer Infant. And the case went to hearing. Judge Hamilton rendered his decision and denied the motion for preliminary injunction. From that point forward, my understanding is that Ms. DeMartinez was free to work for Summer Infant.
The reason I ask about the status, if discovery proceeds apace, application can be made again for a preliminary injunction, right?
There's no reason that it could not be, Your Honor. I think Judge Hamilton noted in his findings that if he refers to that possibility. He says if additional facts come to bear, there may be a different finding on similar or related issues.
So we're just, we've got this gap here where we don't, I guess maybe we're not supposed to know what went on, where she is or whether she's working, whether there's been, that's what's sort of frustrating here. The injunction was denied and now we're many months later and you at least maybe feel obligated to say you don't know what she's doing or what she did or where she's working or what area she's working in or anything else. I guess that would be the subject of a new motion for an injunction if this one is, I don't want to say it's obsolete, but moot or something. How do we rule or judge on something that is this old?
Well, that's precisely the problem, Your Honor, is that this is old, that this issue, if you will, has a short shelf life. It was a six-month injunction, and that 6 months has passed.
So we're three blind mice up here, right?
I wouldn't say that, Your Honor.
No. Okay.
Our position is that the case is moot, and on the record of what the relief has been asked for. The substance of the case, however...
Of course, in the reply brief, Durrell argues that even if the information isn't a trade secret, it's confidential, and its release would violate the confidentiality agreement, and so an injunction should issue. You didn't have a chance to respond to that argument.
We did not, Your Honor, but the Indiana trade secret statute provides for relief if trade secrets are being revealed. Whatever the state of play would be, I don't want to anticipate what allegations there would be because that's beyond the record, but whatever the allegations are, it's going to be a steep hill to climb in light of Judge Hamilton's findings that he's already made about the state of...
Are you saying that the contract claim is beyond the record?
No,
because that's a contract claim, and they're saying that that would be enough to support an injunction here.
Well, I think the contract claim is mentioned in the complaint. It is referred in passing at best to both the motion for preliminary injunction, also the pre-hearing briefs that were submitted. Really, the focus is on the Indiana trade secret statute. There is a contract claim, and that is what's pending before Judge Hamilton today. Whether the plaintiff can make a case for some sort of equitable relief pursuant to the contract claim, that's what I don't want to anticipate or guess is what that argument might be. But the factual findings made by Judge Hamilton already regarding the purported trade secrets, again, make that a steep hill to climb. The judge has made two different findings. One is that this information is not a trade secret. He found, he made various findings on this point, all of them factual findings. The statute itself is very clear. It's information that derives independent economic value from not being generally known to and not being readily ascertainable by proper means by other persons who can obtain economic value from the information. Judge Hamilton made a finding that this information is described. There are three different areas of trade, purported trade secrets. Summer Infant can't derive economic value from that information. And
you mean because of what he found? He said there's no information left. There's nothing to get.
What he found was that the information is stale. It is old. The first one that what's sometimes referred to as a two-tier strategy is at least 6 months old, and Ms. DeMartinez's access to that information was limited at best.
Well, was that based on the fact that she had a child, expecting another, wanted to do more family things, et cetera, that she was sort of out of the loop anyway? Is that part of the testimony that he's making his findings on?
Judge Hamilton made the finding that Ms. DeMartinez had been on the sidelines, is his term. Not completely, but for the most part, on the sideline for 8 months. The record reflects that she went on maternity leave in February, had some communications, attended some meetings, then in early June went on unpaid leave to tend to her child and had...
The child was sick.
That's right.
Yeah. Based on the record, what could Ms. DeMartinez have done in the last 6 or 8 months? What are restrictions? What could she do at work? Just based on the record, since that seems to be what we're confined to here. In your view, what limitations did she have? What could she do for the new employer?
Ms. DeMartinez was subject to a confidentiality agreement, and I think is bound by that agreement according to its terms. There is an issue here as to whether that information is in fact a trade secret. Judge Hamilton found that the three areas are not trade secrets and not entitled to the protection by the Indiana Trade Secret Act. But I believe that Ms. DeMartinez is subject to a confidentiality agreement. She needs to continue to abide by that. She, on this record, testified that she would continue to abide by that. Moreover, she's entered into agreement with her new employer, Summer Infant, that she will not disclose confidential information. And Summer Infant has the principals of Summer Infant testified that they expect that she will abide by her obligations pursuant to the confidentiality agreement. That's what the record shows are her obligations going forward from October 20th, 2006.
That's one of the reasons she went back in the office to get a copy of that in order to go over it with the prospective new employer.
That was Ms. DeMartinez's testimony.
They reviewed that before they hired her.
That's the record, Your Honor, yes.
Yeah.
Can I take you to a different area for just a minute? It seemed to me that you were asking us to require a showing of bad faith in making out a claim for inevitable disclosure. Am I correct, or?
No, Your Honor. And if our brief suggests that, then I respectfully apologize for that. The element of bad faith in the inevitable disclosure analysis is, just as it was in the PepsiCo case, an element or a factual determination that informs the finder of fact as to whether the disclosure is indeed inevitable. A number of findings on this record, in addition to the lack of bad faith, is that the Ms. DeMartinez has been on the sidelines for 8 months, that the information is stale, that she's assuming different positions, and that has promised to abide by the confidentiality provisions. There are a number of cases where the judge makes a credibility determination as to what the defendant intends to do. Frequently, a defendant who testifies that he or she will abide by confidentiality provisions is not credible because he or she have taken other steps that undermine that testimony. They have misled the employer or intentionally availed himself or herself of trade secrets.
Now, let me tell you where I got that idea. It was from your number four. The district court correctly ruled that a plaintiff must present evidence that the defendant or her new employer acted in bad faith or otherwise engaged in misconduct to obtain a preliminary injunction on an inevitable disclosure claim absent a non-competition agreement. So, yes, your brief.
I understand, Your Honor.
Yep. Because you say here, Durrell asked this court to do what no other high court has done. Enjoin a former employee from working for a competitor when there is no evidence of bad faith. Blah, and onward. So, okay, well then I guess you cleared that up.
I don't think the bad faith aspect rises to the level of a legal requirement in the doctrine of inevitable disclosure, but clearly it is something in which all courts consider when they evaluate. The Indiana statute talks about a threatened disclosure of the information. The former employee's bad faith is a critical element, particularly in making the credibility determination that a court must make in terms of trying to determine, as Judge Hamilton frequently says throughout the transcript, we're trying to look into the future to see whether the disclosure is in fact inevitable. And the bad faith is clearly of interest to any trier of fact who's got to make that determination.
Yeah, but it certainly shouldn't be required to make out a claim.
I agree, Your Honor, that there may be circumstances in which the court could find inevitable disclosure in the absence of bad faith.
Would bad faith be something leaving one company and going to another for that kind of a purpose, or would it be considered, as she explained, I guess, although the judge didn't say much about it, that her reason for switching jobs was because of her family demands? Little kids, one sick, needed a lot more time and couldn't take the demands of the supervisory job that she had. And that seemed to be what she was going to be required to do, so she went with what I guess was a less demanding employment. Now, that seems to pervade, at least in her testimony. I just wondered if is that part of the record that the judge considered, not only the long period of time that she was really taking time off and having children and taking care of the baby, but also her future desire, her future career goals were less ambitious given the children.
Judge Hamilton clearly credits Ms. DeMartinez's testimony regarding her decision to leave Durrell and join Summer Infant, and he stated that explicitly on the record. Ms. DeMartinez, her testimony, which is in the record, tracks what Your Honor has stated here, that's the reason she sought a different position. Again, Judge Hamilton credited that testimony, found her very credible, and therefore came to the conclusion that she had no bad faith. Compare that situation to the PepsiCo versus Redmond case, where Redmond essentially lies to his former employer, participates in customer meetings, and then subsequently informs his former employer that he's leaving to go to a competitor. That's the bad faith. And again, this court found that was a close call, but one could read the opinion to say that the bad faith tipped the scales in favor of granting the motion for preliminary injunction. And that was the role that bad faith played in that case. And that's a factual example of what role it does play. In this case, however, Judge Hamilton specifically found Ms. DeMartinez to be credible in her explanation of why she left Durrell and went to Summer Infant. Judge Hamilton, just to touch on Judge Roedner's comment about the absence of a non-compete, Judge Hamilton, I think, in that section of his opinion, was simply noting the fact that the motion for preliminary injunction sought what it attempted to bargain for but could not, that is a non-compete. There was no non-compete provision here. And I think a fair reading of Judge Hamilton's opinion is that this was a case where the information, purported trade secrets, were stale, were not of great use to Summer Infant, and that the motion for preliminary injunction amounted to an attempt to keep Mr. DeMartinez from participating in the industry based on her general industry knowledge and her background in that, rather than on specific information that she had been exposed to while she was at Durrell. And I think that's the context of Judge Hamilton's comments on that point, and it simply reflects a common sense view of that.
Well, I still have that curiosity of what she's been doing for the last 6 or 8 months, but I guess that's what the next next procedure, huh?
If there is one, Your Honor.
Yeah, well.
Similarly, Judge Hamilton found that there was no irreparable harm here. Having found that there was no likelihood of success on the merits and no irreparable harm, the inquiry under this court's case law ends. Judge Hamilton did, though, continue on and note for the record that he viewed the balance of harms to be essentially equal. Ms. DeMartinez had testified that her integrity and her reputation in her industry had been damaged, which is beyond monetary compensation, and that Judge Hamilton noted that there's really no public interest to be gained here. So after having evaluated the credibility of the witness and properly applied the law, Judge Hamilton's decision is entitled to deference, and we would ask the court to affirm that decision.
Thank you, Mr. Finger. Ms. Peters, I know your time has expired, but you may have an additional 3 minutes.
I appreciate that.
And let me chew into it a little bit.
assuming, that is your prerogative.
Well, it's shared time. At least that's my view. Some judges may have a little different view, but that's mine. Assuming we're past mootness, that your position is found not wanting and we have a controversy. I asked about ongoing proceedings because I wondered if discovery continues apace. So that would be my first inquiry.
In terms of the status below, shortly after the Judge Hamilton declined to enter the injunction, I made a motion to amend the complaint to name Summer Infant because Summer Infant, she went to work for Summer Infant. Judge Hamilton held that, said he didn't even want to let Summer Infant be a party until this court ruled. And as a result of that, I didn't want to proceed with what would be expensive discovery.
No, I appreciate it. I'm not being critical about the process. But here's what concerns me, and that's why I went over a little bit before with the findings by the judge. He had before him and apparently accepted this testimony that she had no, that is, Ms. DeMartinez did not have information concerning the 07 or 08 product lines, communication strategies, price points, feature sets, manufacturing costs, or profit margins, and that no one at Summer at Infant had asked her for information, and she hadn't disclosed any. The way I read his findings, he must have found that to be the case, at least for purposes of his conclusion. So do we have a situation where perhaps this preliminary injunction request fails of proof or balance of equities, where perhaps it wouldn't in a future setting, where history could fill in the blanks that Judge Rovner and Judge Mannion, interestingly and appropriately, are concerned about, what's the state of the world today? I mean, I don't want to speak for them on mootness, but just for the purposes of our discussion today.
Yeah, I thought you were going to, you asked a question to Mr. Finger that suggested that. Judge Hamilton made a number of legal errors that need to be corrected regardless of the deference that the court's paying.
Why don't you list those?
Let me deal with those. One is Judge Hamilton appeared to require that Durrell prove bad faith. Indeed, as Judge Rovner recognized, both parties thought that Judge Hamilton had required there be bad. I don't think that there's any requirement that there be bad faith. He said that trade secrets that are going to become public in the future are not entitled to protection. That's an error as a matter of law.
Was he speaking for the purposes of the injunction that day, or could he? Is that a fair reading that he was saying that the future it wouldn't be as you state?
He was very explicit that he was looking at those becoming public in the future in terms of proving a reasonable likelihood of success on the merits, and as a result of that, he was saying that, and I don't think he necessarily said, he certainly didn't make a specific Rule 52 finding that there was no trade secret, but he did say that these are not entitled to protection because they're going to be public they're going to become public in the future. Well, that would turn trade secret law on its head if that were to remain the law. And that's to answer one of your questions to Mr. Finger, Judge Flom, in terms of, well, maybe we should deny this and you can go and make another motion for a preliminary injunction. I'd suggest that that's a mistake for two reasons. One procedural and the other practical. The procedural concern is there are errors and that this court does stand as a reviewing court in the rule of law in terms of the importance of correcting errors of law. And I don't think any of us in this room should lose the importance and the value of that. There's also a much more, from my perspective, a practical effect in that this case is going to proceed. And that to the extent that there are errors of the law, those need to be corrected in order to give guidance for future proceedings.
We have his oral conclusions. He did not convert it into writing, and that's why I'm suggesting maybe there's a little flex in interpreting whether or not those errors of law are as bold as they might have been if they jumped off the written page. But the words are the words, and I suggest that maybe the bad faith issue is, as both you and I think Mr. Finger agree, perhaps not a requirement. So if he mentioned bad faith, maybe he's mentioning it in the context of it's something that can be a fact to be considered, not a determiner of the outcome. And as to the trade secrets, I think that speculation language, I agree with you, it could turn the law upside down if one were to read it as you read it. I'm not suggesting it can't be read that way, but if we corrected that, is there still the factual underpinnings that will justify the injunction in June 1st of 07?
Yes, and I think that turns back where we started in terms of the mootness. There is a very real need here because my client still has trade secrets. These brand positioning strategies are still very valuable, very viable, and that Ms. DeMartinez and now Summer Infant shouldn't be able to continue to use those.
I think that's where Judge Hamilton's coming from, that you're trying to convert it into a non-compete. I'm not suggesting. I'm thinking that's his read of your action, not your intent, necessarily. So, we'll just have to We'll have to do that. I took up much of your time. Do you have a concluding thought that you may certainly go forward with that?
Well, I had several concluding thoughts, but what in terms of the non-compete issue, let me just say this, in that I understand the need, and there's a certain desire, and indeed Judge Mannion, I think, was getting to that. There's sympathies here, and that there's a desire to a concern about protecting Ms. DeMartinez. And I'd say that there's two aspects to that. The law balances that concern in terms of employee mobility and the desire to let people move with the need to protect intellectual property by saying that if it is in fact confidential information, that information is entitled to be protected regardless of the concerns about mobility, that the law values that. And that is all that Durrell is trying to do here. She knowingly entered into a confidentiality agreement. We're not trying to prevent her from going to work for Summer Infant. She's free to work for Summer Infant. What we're asking in terms of relief is that she be prevented from working in positions that inherently will use the trade secrets, because she's asked to answer the question, what to expect from Durrell. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Peters. Thank you, Mr. Finger. Thanks to all counsel. The case is taken.